This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
And I'm Gofen Putubwele. There are about 193 countries in the world. In 89 of them, The Sandman is the most popular show on Netflix.
So this is the Neil Gaiman show, of course, based on his comic series. I have to admit, Gofen, I don't follow fantasy that closely, but Neil Gaiman's got a huge list of really successful books. I don't think there's anyone even close to him in the genre right now. What draws you to his work?
His books ask readers to trust him and step into this new world, and then the world always delivers. I think one of my favorites is his story, The Graveyard Book, where this baby, his parents are killed, and then he gets adopted by ghosts in a graveyard, and the story sort of unspools from there. Or the story Coraline, or the series American Gods. There's just so many stories that are kind of filled with these like fantastical tales that are really great.
How involved was he in the new Netflix adaptation of Sandman?
Super involved, which is one of the things that's very cool about it. This is not the situation where the author says, I'm selling the rights and hopefully they don't mess it up. He was getting dailies, like the shots of what they recorded every day. He helped on the script. He helped with casting. He was very, very involved. And I think that the result is something that is as expansive and dreamy as the rest of his canon.
We begin. In the waking world, which humanity insists on calling the real world. As if your dreams have no effect upon the choices you make.
I want to take you back to December of 1988. Where were you in your life? What happened or was about to happen?
I had just turned 28 years old. I'd been 27 that year. And my first DC comic had been published about a month before, 6 weeks before.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Black Orchid number one. And now Sandman number one is coming out. I go to America. I come to New York. Mm-hmm. Where I meet Mike Dringenberg,
okay.
Who is the artist, and I met Mike for the first time there. And the two of us went out to Jim Hanley's universe on Staten Island, if memory serves,
okay.
To do a comic book signing. And in front of us, we have piles of Sandman 1. We have about 13, maybe 14 young men between the ages of 16 and 22.
Okay, okay.
Waiting for us to sign stuff, and we signed stuff for them, and then that was it. That was our Sandman number one signing. As big events go, it wasn't. And what I love is looking back on it as Sandman signings became bigger and bigger, but also became more and more inclusive.
Mm.
There was the point somewhere in year two where I realized that the lines were no longer exclusively male.
Mm.
And probably by year three, they were 50% female. And around that point, I would go to conventions and large, sweaty gentlemen would come over to me, grab my hands and say, "You brought women into my store. My comic book store had not seen a woman. You bring them in. You do Sandman. Let me shake your hand, man."
So can you explain just the premise of Sandman and who the main character Morpheus is and what his domain is like?
Of course. So the premise of Sandman is that there is a place that you go every night when you close your eyes, fast asleep. You are actually visiting a place called the Dreaming. And the Dreaming is ruled by Morpheus, King of Dreams.
Dream of the endless. Summon the fates. The three who are one. The one who is three. The Hecate.
Morpheus. It's been a while.
You look thin, love. Are you eating? Are you hungry?
He is, but not for food. Look at him. He wants something.
You've found me out. I do want something. I need your help.
Help?
About 106 years ago, he was captured by a British occultist and imprisoned in a glass globe in a basement. And prepared to outlive and outwait his captors. And eventually, he escaped and discovered that his realm was in ruins. Our dreams have been partly ruined, and powerful dreams had escaped into the waking world.
One of the things that I love about your writing is that it feels so, for me, it feels like I get into a plane and then it like takes me up really, really high. And there's just so much space and so much like room to imagine. It just feels like there's so much, like even the way that you describe it, it's like you could say the premise of Sandman is about dreaming and dreams, but you know, you kind of like spin this beautiful tale and it makes me think like, wow, I want to soak up this world. I know that you did some journalism early on. Do you think that there are ways to bring that sort of like, I don't know if we call it fantasy or fantastical or roominess or space into nonfiction? Can we bring that sort of roominess into like what we consider factual?
I think we have to. The concept of suspension of disbelief is a fascinating one for me. And it continues to be sort of the thing that I look at and go, well, this is my engine. This is my place. My job is to make you believe in something that is not true and did not happen to people who do not exist. And to make you care about those people and those things that did not happen that I'm just making up. And if I do my job correctly, to send you back into your life feeling different, feeling like you've experienced something that you haven't experienced before, maybe even seeing the world a little bit differently. Episode 6 of Sandman, I took Kirby, Hal Baptiste, who plays Death, aside, you know, here we are, we're at the San Diego Comic Convention. And I said to Kirby, look, it suddenly occurs to me that I should have told you this a year ago. I should have told you this when we were shooting this. I should have warned you before you took the part. And I didn't. So let me just tell you now that for the rest of your life, people are going to come up to you and say, my son died, my daughter died, my grandfather died, my husband died, my lover died, my friend died, somebody that I cared about died. And I watched you in that episode, The Sound of Her Wings, meeting people.
As death.
As death. And it let me cope. I've been having people coming up to me for 30 years saying, your death got me through this. There is a real, in terms of suspension of disbelief, it's you're telling things, you're making things that aren't true. You're making these big, roomy things with space that are not true, and you're giving them to people in order to allow them to see, we hope, greater truths. What fascinates me is that suspension of disbelief is incredibly fragile, and it will pop on tiny things, and it pops in the same way on as fiction as nonfiction. You know, I remember reading an otherwise wonderful book in which somebody time travels back to the 17th century. They're in London, and they say, excuse me, where is such and such street? And the person says, oh, it's two blocks over. And the concept of the city block has not yet arrived in London. The idea that it would have arrived there in the 17th century with the tangle of London streets is impossible. And from that point on, much as I loved the book, I found it impossible to believe anything or take anything seriously. My suspension of disbelief has now gone. I was walking with you, and I have now let go of your hand, and I'm looking at you curiously. So I think that for journalism, for fiction, for nonfiction alike, the most important thing is just trying to cultivate trust, and you cultivate trust by a certain accuracy, by just checking your facts, by not telling people things that they know are not true, because then they're gone.
At some point in the series, we go to hell.
Tell us, why should we let you leave? Helmet or no, you have no power here. After all, what power have dreams? In hell.
I wonder if you could just describe that domain.
Well, hell in The Sandman was very much inspired by Dante's Inferno. It is a place where you get things like the wood of suicides, and each tree in the wood was once a person who has died by their own hand. People everywhere. People make up the fabric of hell. The walls of hell are made of people. The buildings are made of people and of rocks and of thorns. It's huge. It's expanding. In Blake's phrase, the dark satanic mills definitely grinding away there. And over it all, ruling it all, is Lucifer Morningstar. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. And Lucifer is absolutely down for reigning in hell.
Pater noster, qui es in celis, sanctificetur nomen tuum, adveniam regnum.
You talked about going into that suspension of disbelief, coming out and seeing your world in a slightly different light. What is it that in The Sandman either you hope people see in a different light, or that you yourself saw in a different light at the end of having written it?
What fascinated me about hell always, I think I was about 11, and somebody asked a biology teacher of mine if he believed in hell. And he quoted somebody, it's actually a quote from somebody called the Abbé Mounier. And he said, I have to believe in hell because it is church doctrine that there is a hell. I am under no obligation to believe that there is anybody there.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that. That for me was sort of the primary building block of hell. And I thought, okay, what if everybody in hell is there because on some deep, profound level, they want to be there. Mm. They believe they should be there. They are punishing themselves. That allowed me to begin to build a hell that I could work with in fiction. For me, you don't really write about hell. You write about hell in order to make concrete metaphors and ideas. So the idea of hell is a place of punishment. The idea that, you know, at one point Lucifer says, turns to Morpheus and says, well, you know, you have no power here. What power has dreams in hell? And he says, what power would hell have if those who are imprisoned here could not dream of heaven? And that, for me, that's what it's all about. It's like, why build a hell? Well, you build a hell so you can deliver those kind of ideas, you can take those metaphors, so you can play with those stories, and you can actually make people think about them and go, whoa, okay, that's an idea. How does that apply to my life?
Last question is, in August 2022, your show is number one in 89 countries. In December of 1988, you're just about to, you're in a bookstore signing to, you know, a small crowd of people. How is the Neil Gaiman of 2022 different than the Neil Gaiman of 88?
I'm in some ways the same. I'm still curious and I still love making things. I think he was much more driven than I am. Partly, I guess, because I've done so many of the things that he dreamed of doing. You know, all these sort of things that have mean that I feel like I've actually written my name on the wall. And that if I die tomorrow, my name will have been written on the wall. It may not be written very large or very legibly or even anywhere that people can see it, but I know I wrote it. And he, as a 28-year-old, was going, I want to write my name on the wall. And I want to make good stuff. And I think if I just keep making good stuff, sooner or later, my name will have been written on the wall. And I'd love to be able to go back in time and tell him, I think he was probably right.
Neil Gaiman talking with our producer, Gofen Mputubwele. The Sandman, adapted from the Gaiman series of graphic novels, is out on Netflix. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The Republican Party has made it very clear that it has no place for black activism. At every level, leaders of the party demonize the Black Lives Matter movement and what they characterize as the teaching of critical race theory in the schools. The GOP opposes affirmative action and almost any effort to redress discrimination in the present. In some quarters, simply acknowledging that racism exists is considered unpatriotic. And yet recently, the Republican Party has also attracted increasing numbers of black candidates to its fold. The website 538 recently published a report that was headlined, "A Record Number of Black Republicans Could Be Headed to Congress," and it cited some 80 or more candidates. That's a very stark contrast to the current statistics, 2 black representatives and 1 single senator in the GOP. So what exactly is going on? To get some perspective, I spoke with Professor Leah Wright-Rigger, a historian at Johns Hopkins University. She's the author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican, a book that covers the period from the New Deal through the Reagan administration. Professor, you wrote some time ago a book about black Republicans. I'd love to know, what is the trend among the African-American community where the Republican Party is concerned? We would assume, maybe wrongly, that in the wake of the Trump years, that these numbers would have gone down.
That assumption rests on a couple of things. One, we are actually, I think, blinded by the partisanship of black voters. So we look at that relationship between African-Americans in the Democratic Party, which has been very consistent since 1964, and we say, well, the majority of African-Americans vote for Democrats, so that's just the way it is. And so one of the things that we have noticed, particularly since Barack Obama is no longer in office, right, so there's no longer a black male president in office, that the tensions in the relationship between the Democratic Party and black voters has grown a little more tense. And with that comes an increase in the number of black non-voters. So people who say, I opt out of the political process. There comes an increase in the number of black third party voters. People who say, well, you know, I'm going for Bernie, or I'm going for Andrew Yang, or something like that. And then, of course, there comes a very small, but I think pivotal group of black voters who say, you know what? I'm going to the Republican Party. Again, it feels really shocking that it would happen during the era of Trumpism. I'm not going to say Donald Trump because it's bigger than Donald Trump, right? It feels really surprising. And yet, when you realize that the tension with the two-party system is at the root of it, it actually makes sense that in the aftermath of Barack Obama, with black people's levels of support and warmth for the Democratic Party in decline, and the belief amongst a small sect of African Americans that the Democratic Party is just as racist as the Republican Party, that actually frees some people up to actually vote Republican. And that's what we're seeing right now in 2022.
So you're describing a number of trends, if I'm getting this right, which is
right.
So, what are the numbers?
Well, we honestly can't measure anything by the barometer of Barack Obama, because he was unique in a lot of ways. The number one way is that he motivates Black voters, but in particular Black male voters, to come out in record numbers. Numbers that, you know, we haven't seen since the 1965 Voting Rights Act is passed into legislation and all kinds of new Black voters come into the party. And so when Barack Obama is no longer on the ticket, it changes everything. Then add to that, you put somebody like Hillary Clinton on the ticket, a certain segment of the Black community says, well, wait a second, this is the same person who, you know, used the infamous phrase super predators, and whose husband as president, you know, presided over the crime bill. And so what we end up seeing, of course, is a drop off in the number of people that come out for the Democratic Party. I believe Hillary Clinton still gets more than 90% of the Black vote. We do see a number of African Americans who vote for the Republican candidate, in this case, Donald Trump.
In fact, the figures from Pew say that Black support for Trump went from 6% in the first election to 8% in 2020. Now, those might be small numbers, but still, it's a little mind-boggling.
I won't say mind-boggling because it's still very much within the trend of Republican presidential candidates over the last 55 years.
But it wasn't any Republican candidate. This is Donald Trump of Charlottesville. This is Donald Trump of his immigration policies. It's Donald Trump of a thousand other things that we could name all day long. And yet there was a slight increase in the Black voters.
The feelings of warmth of African Americans towards the Democratic Party has been on the decline. And I'll tell you what, Republican strategists understand that that matters. They may not understand why. They may not care about, you know, the meat and potatoes of it. And they may not have anything to offer those disgruntled individuals, but they sure do know how to exploit that division.
How would you describe the ideological diversity of the African-American community and the African-American vote?
Partisanship actually forces us to ignore so much of that richness of ideological diversity that exists amongst Black voters. Angela K. Lewis, about a decade ago, comes out with a book that talks about African-Americans and conservatism. And she says, there's such a thing as everyday conservatism that exists amongst African-Americans.
But what does that mean, everyday conservatism?
Well, it's conservatism in terms of values, belief, religion that doesn't translate into partisanship. And at any given time, it fluctuates between about 20 to 33% of African Americans self-identifying as conservative. So oftentimes you'll see Republicans who are like, oh, this is a natural relationship between African Americans and the Republican Party. Clarence Thomas says this all the time in his speeches. But the truth is, African Americans won't support candidates, in particular Republican candidates, if they believe them to be racist or not have the best interest of African Americans in mind.
Professor, at the last count of the Republican National Committee, there were around 120 Black Republican candidates running at the state, local, and federal level, 80 of them running for Congress. Why do you think there's a record number of Black Republicans who are running for office this time around?
That is actually pretty easy. It's support from the Republican institutions. And so that's what's different from previous years. You know, in the past, there have been lots and lots of Black Republicans who have run for office at every level. I think about a candidate like Kim Classic, who raised a lot of money, I think in the millions of dollars, from small donations, grassroots donations, ran to replace Elijah Cummings. She had a viral campaign. She even ends up getting a shout out from Donald Trump, right? He reshares her commercial. But in something that really goes unnoticed after her campaign, she complains that she gets no support from the Republican infrastructure. In fact, it is a consistent complaint that Black Republicans have really made since the 1960s. We also know, looking at internal documents from Republican institutions, that by and large, Republicans don't like supporting Black candidates, particularly because they believe that Black candidates cannot win.
But even in a district like Elijah Cummings?
Black voters, if they believe that a candidate does not have their community's best interests in mind, will actually punish that Black candidate more than if that candidate was white, right? And why do they do that? Because it feels like a betrayal. It feels like treason, right? Racial treason.
So when you look at a race like Georgia, the Senate race in Georgia, mm-hmm. you have Herschel Walker, who was a very good running back long ago. But I think it's fair to say that if you look at his performance as a candidate, it's been a misery, a misery. He doesn't know the issues. He says disastrous things day in and day out. It seems like a very cynical operation on many levels.
It's a very cynical operation. And if Herschel Walker wins in Georgia, which he might, it won't be because of Black voters. And I'll tell you why, because, we can look at polling. We can look at how African-Americans are talking about Herschel Walker, and they don't respect him. They don't believe that he actually has the best interest of the community in mind. They think that, he's a plant, that he's propaganda. And I think actually the Republican Party knows that Herschel Walker is not winning over anyone in the Black community. What they're banking on is that there will be enough white voters and non-Black voters to push Herschel Walker over the finish line. Right. Anything that they pick up in that race in Georgia, any Black votes that they pick up in that race won't be expected. And in fact, what we see is that Black Republican candidates do well in two kinds of areas. If they are in predominantly Black areas or where Black votes matter dramatically, they do well when they avoid controversial racial topics or at least show that they have organic connections to African-American communities. The other area where they do well is in predominantly white areas that are conservative. Mm-hmm. And in that respect, they don't have to do very much except echo whatever the standard bearer of the party needs them to echo.
But the Republican Party today is capable on a daily basis of stone-cold racial and racist pronouncements. And only 20% of registered Republicans seem to be pushing back hard against this. Mm-hmm. But he is still where he is, Donald Trump. And Trumpism will outlast Trump, as you began our conversation
Absolutely.
Saying. So what place is there for African Americans in the Republican Party? And how will that possibly increase in such an atmosphere?
So this is the irony, right? Which is that in a moment where the party is not just going through an identity crisis, but instead has really wholeheartedly embraced white grievance politics, right? And policy explicitly, is also the moment where they are endorsing more Black candidates than they have in really the past, 25 years. And so part of that, again, is about maximizing and really exploiting the opportunity that exists because of the breakdown in the relationship between the Democratic Party and Black voters. And so the congressional hearings on Russian interference in the 2016 election and again in the 2020 election have revealed that a lot of these institutions that really were, employed by the Republican Party pumped money into exploiting those tensions because they realized this is an opportunity. And it is an opportunity of the like that we haven't seen in really years.
Right. Many of the candidates who are running in predominantly white districts, Black candidates, somebody like mm-hmm. Wesley Hunt in Texas or John James in Michigan, what kind of chance do they have, and what issues are they campaigning on, and how are they talking about race?
Sure. So, James is actually really interesting. So, again, I'll compare it again to somebody like Herschel Walker, right, who talks about race all the time in ways that are really alienating and off-putting, right? As opposed to James, who really seems to be far more delicate about this and about avoiding those controversial things while simply hitting the talking points of inflation, right? The economy, right? Those are things that it is easy to rally around because everyone is feeling it. And I think in particular, like when we look at polling data from across all racial groups, the thing that is consistent across these racial groups is that they care about the economy. They care about inflation. They care about jobs. And so if you're a Republican right now, you don't want to run on Roe. You don't want to run on like critical race theory, because it is a much easier and far more effective strategy to simply run on the fact that right now, right?
Not 9% inflation.
Right. Things cost a lot, right?
What are some of the hurdles or obstacles that Black Republicans face once they actually get in office?
It is constantly a struggle to be a racial minority in your political party. And that even if you fundamentally believe that the Republican Party is doing good, it is another thing altogether to sit in those rooms, right, with those people who have access to immense power and be treated like a second-class citizen, right? And, you know, by and large, they don't use that kind of language. It's far more careful. Although during the Trump years, I think they had to be far more outspoken. And many of them ended up, I think, paying the price for that.
Like Mia Love.
Right, like Mia Love. Or Will Hurd, who declines to run. And once he declines to run, that's when he starts, you know, speaking out about his experience in the party. We also know that, again, there's absolutely no reward for, I think, critiquing or offering constructive criticism for the party in a moment, the moment that is now. And I'm not even talking about, you know, along racial lines, right? I'm saying, look at what's happening to Liz Cheney, right? She's a pariah. And so we can look at that and see that the experience is the same for Black Republicans. Tim Scott is an interesting figure because he really has tried to walk a tightrope of holding fast to an investment in poor and Black communities, right? So he's done a number of initiatives around this issue. He's come out on issues of criminal justice reform, right? A number of these issues, while also recognizing that the second that he speaks out or distances himself explicitly from his party and from the standard of Trumpism, that he will be punished for that, as he is right now.
Let's look in our in our crystal ball, or you look in yours. How are all those Black Republican candidates going to do in 2022 in the midterms? What's your prognostication?
So I'm going to go based on what has been historically true, at least over the last 55 years, which is that Republicans, including Black Republicans, tend to do better during midterm elections amongst Black voters. Anything between 10 to actually 35% is completely normal during midterm elections. It is entirely possible that whoever the Republican candidate is gets 10%, 12%, you know, even 15% of the Black vote. Anything within that framework is completely normal and to be expected.
Leah Wright Rigueur is a professor of history at Johns Hopkins University. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's more to come.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted, brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. President Joe Biden's political appeal, though it may be in peril at the moment, is inseparable from his persona. His empathetic folksiness, his modest upbringing in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and the aphorisms from his father about the dignity of work, it's all a major part of his electoral appeal. And yet that version of Biden's childhood is woefully incomplete, as the writer Adam Entus put it recently in The New Yorker. Adam has done a deep investigation into Joseph Biden Sr. and other of the president's forebears, and he's uncovered a family history that's far more complex than the one that the president likes to share. It involves boom and bust finances, war profiteering, polo matches, yachts, and a real history of alcohol abuse, too. Adam Entus talks about Biden's family on our podcast, Politics and More. It's hosted this week by Tyler Foggett. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Emma, you seem to be broadcasting from the ballroom.
Ha! Yes. We have a New York City closet that is, I guess, almost the size of habitability. Like, this could count as a studio in some parts of New York City.
Exactly. Maybe you could put a stove and a shower in there, too. I talked the other day with Emma Green, who took her microphone into the closet. Emma joined The New Yorker as a staff writer last fall, and I asked her what's been on her mind lately. Emma, you cover academia and cultural conflict and politics and religion, and lately you've been writing, no surprise, about the pro-life or anti-abortion movement. How did you come to start reporting on this?
So it's been one of my subbeats for a long time. And just from a writerly perspective, I've always found this question, the abortion question, to be one that really has so much space for exploration. The political conversation is locked into these binaries, but when you take it out of that frame and start talking about abortion and asking questions about abortion in a way that's personal, that gets at the really hard situations that people can get in, I think it really shows us something about the human condition. It shows us something about life, some of the hardest situations in life, and sometimes the most, you know, wonderful situations in life.
In order to help you understand and help our listeners understand the pro-life movement, I think you've chosen three things to share with us that you think will give us some deeper perspective. Which one of those would you like to talk about first?
So we'll start with this book. And just for fair warning, this is a book that was written by one of my neighbors. But even if she wasn't one of my neighbors, I would have loved this book. It really changed the way that I thought about abortion. It's called High Risk. And the woman's name is Javi Eve Karkowski. She is a maternal fetal medicine specialist in New York. And she was writing about all of the ways that as an MFM, someone who regularly is dealing with not only abortion, but also really, really tough situations with high-risk pregnancies, how her frame around pregnancy questions has changed over her life as a doctor. So here's a little excerpt from her book, a scene that really stuck with me. Some of us are calling it a baby. Some of us are calling it a fetus. Some of us are calling it. Although we catch ourselves when we do. None of us feel good about any of this. We're all talking to Annie Riley, but really to her whole family. She's pregnant, 23 weeks and 0 days by our best estimates. Until yesterday, she was having a normal, uncomplicated pregnancy. And then yesterday, when she was running errands, her water broke. She came to see us, and while being evaluated, she became uncomfortable. Now she's in labor. We're trying to stop the labor, this complicated process by which our body works to eject the contents of the uterus. Our treatments for this situation are old, not terribly effective. Right now, it looks very much like she'll be delivering within the next few hours or days. So we're in her room, talking and talking about the pregnancy, about the fetus, about the baby. Is it a baby or a fetus? That's the thing, really, the crux of the matter. We need her to tell us. Across America, there are somewhat different standards around when a fetus is viable outside of the mother's womb. The earliest that hospitals will do it really is 22 weeks. Most hospitals will definitely try to offer life-saving care at 24 weeks, but this woman is in the gray zone. She's at 23. And so what Javi is describing is this experience as a doctor relying on the patient to say, is this a stillbirth? Is this a situation where, tragically, with a one in pregnancy, I went into labor before I was ready, and we know that the baby's going to die, and we're going to, you know, do comfort measures, we're going to let this be a loss? Or is this a situation of a really, 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 really premature baby? And that line not really being clear, even to Javi, who has the highest level of medical training that you can have in the field of obstetrics and gynecology, that was really powerful for me because it showed that often when it comes down to it, the way that we experience pregnancy, pregnancy loss, the decision to terminate a pregnancy, to not move forward, there's a level of ambiguity there. It's not so defined and scientifically determined.
So, Emma, so the first is high risk, because that book sounds fascinating. What's your second?
So I want to point the listeners towards an expert who I rely on all the time in my reporting. Her name is Mary Ziegler, and she is just fabulous. She writes about the pro-life movement. She's written about it from a money perspective, from a legal perspective, from a history perspective. She's a legal historian. So there was a tweet that she wrote on the day that Dobbs came out. This was June 24th. She said, I have 12 minutes free for the first time today, and it's beginning to sink in. And to me, that was like, oh, you know, this is really hitting her in the historical sense. And she started offering perspective over that day and the next few days, trying to help people understand the long tail of this. She wrote, will there be a backlash to today's decision? Don't expect to know in 2022. In 1973, Roe was only the third story on ABC. Isn't that amazing?
It is incredible.
It's incredible. Stevens answered zero questions on Roe in 1975 in his confirmation hearings. Backlash is unpredictable, takes time, and is shaped by many other actors. Sort of framing the way that that history comes to bear. I think she's one of the best experts out there when it comes to understanding the pro-life movement.
And finally, Emma, you've got another book to share. Could you tell us what it is?
So this book is Defenders of the Unborn, The Pro-Life Movement Before Roe versus Wade. The author's name is Daniel K. Williams. And I picked this out because more than many, many other books, this book helped me to understand that the politics of the pro-life movement haven't always been Republican, and they haven't always been Republican in the way that we think of the Republican Party in 2022. It sort of mixed up my assumptions about the ideological motivations of the pro-life movement and how it got its start in the 20th century. All right. The solution to the woman's problems is neither to offer her abortion nor merely to prohibit it, but rather to demonstrate that there are humane alternatives. This is from a brochure from the Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, and it's from 1971. And it goes on, this means that we must provide counseling, medical care, financial assistance, homes for unwed mothers, adoption agencies, and effective welfare programs. Today, we think about the pro-life movement as being tied 100% to the Republican Party. And it's a Republican Party that is, in large parts, anti-government, believing that the government should be small enough to fit in your pocket. And so it's hard for us to imagine a broad-scale pro-life movement that, on the one hand, argued against abortion, but on the other hand, really, really vigorously wanted social safety net programs, wanted housing programs, financial assistance, medical care, all sorts of programs provided by the government that would help mothers and babies. And moreover, I think it's even harder beyond that to imagine a pro-life movement that also paired with anti-war protest. So Daniel K. Williams, the author, is explaining the evolving politics of the pro-life movement that was very much rooted in the kind of progressive, anti-war, pro-social justice, pro-racial justice movements of the 1960s and 70s. I think we see remnants of that in some neighborhoods of the pro-life movement today. I don't think it's disappeared. But from a political level, I think it's really interesting to understand that the way that the pro-life movement started, and especially where it was prior to Roe, directly prior to Roe, is not the same as the place politically where it is today in 2022.
If I can ask you one last question, after all of your reading, all of your reporting, what do you think is missing from the anti-abortion, pro-choice debate?
So I think that there are a lot of assumptions on both sides about the motivations and desires of either team. The framing by people who are most involved in this issue from a sort of organizational activist perspective often goes like this. On the pro-life side, they accuse people who are pro-choice of being baby killers, of being hostile to the sacredness of life, to, you know, having lots of sex and not wanting to embrace the consequences, just lowest common denominator. And on the other side, on the pro-choice side, there's often the narrative that the pro-life movement is 100% about misogyny, about control, it's about hating women. And I would say that while there can be grains of truth, perhaps, that you can extract from those narratives, when I have met up with activists, and most importantly, when I've met up with real people who are grappling with these decisions, those frames do not at all seem to match what I find. And so I try to stay in that gray zone as a reporter, trying to hold uncertainty, to hold openness to what different people's experiences lead them to believe about some of these really fundamental questions, and just try to be as good of a listener as I can so that I'm not bringing some preconceived frame and putting that on someone.
Emma Green, thank you so much.
Thanks, David.
Emma Green is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and she recommended Javi Eve Karkowski's book, High Risk, Daniel K. Williams's Defenders of the Unborn, and Mary Ziegler's Twitter feed. You can find it all at newyorkerradio.org. That's our program for today. Next week, get ready, because Jennifer Lewis will be joining us, and she's starring in the Showtime series, I Love That for You. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado and Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele,
along with Jeffrey Masters, Wu Coley, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.